Our main speaker is from, thanks for your glasses, Wayne Park. And when I called him, I had, I don't know if you know or not, but chairmen don't get to do a lot of these things. You know, we just get to wander around and enjoy. We get to pick a committee, like I said, that do all the work, and we get to lead this meeting, and we get to pick the main speaker for the night. And so I was discussing this with some people at a little function that I go to on Friday nights, and everybody recommended Red A. I had a big, long, five-page list that had been given to me of speakers, and Red was the first choice, and when I called Red, he accepted, and I'm so grateful.
Hi, everybody. My name is Red Aldridge. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I want to thank Dick and Terry and the rest of the committee. They really treated us royally since we went up here. I'd also, before I start, introduce my bride of 30 years back there. Would you stand up, Ellen? If you newcomers that were have been instructed by your immediate sponsors, no emotional involvements in that first year of sobriety, I want to tell you that sometimes you don't listen too good. Ellen and I have been together on this program sober for a total of 65 years. You can't get too ungrateful for a situation like that. Now, she outranks me 3 years and 10 months on this program. And I can guarantee you she never lets me forget it. But if you're a newcomer, and you're thinking about this, I would pick a mate that outranks you. Because over the years, it's worked out real well. Every time I get into trouble, I say, well, give me 3 years and 10 months. I'll be all right. If she gets out of line, I say, God, anybody with 3 years and 10 months more sobriety than I got should have grown more than that. But I think one of the greatest things that's happened to us is that we've become true friends. And it's very, very seldom that you become true friends with the guy or the gal that you're married to. And the sun never goes down that we don't get all our differences squared away, because we never treat a friend like sometimes you do a husband or a wife. I want to see the guys and gals in this audience that are under 1 year. Can you see the hands? That's great. Now, I'm really not... really not talking to all old-timers then, right? You know, there's no way in the world that I'd ever try to stand up here and tell anybody in this room whether they're alcoholic or not. I don't believe I'm qualified to do that. However, if you happen to start identifying some of these innermost feelings that I'm going to try to describe, some of these symptoms of this terminal disease that I have, I would sure as hell pay attention. Because what we're dealing with here is a terminal disease. Just roll that over your tongue a couple of times. That's got kind of a final ring to it. Means that if you continue to use and abuse the mind-altering drug alcohol, and don't let anybody ever kid you that alcohol is not a drug. Alcohol falls right in the drug category with the ethers and the anesthetics. It's one of the oldest known drugs to man, and it's probably killed more men and women than any other drug. I used it, and I abused it. Over a period of time, regardless of how long it took, until I actually broke my tolerance to it. And if you're new or fairly new and you've been wondering why alcohol has been giving you so much trouble physically, it's because you've become allergic to the drug alcohol. When Old Red drinks alcohol, I break out in spots. Spots like Acapulco, Las Vegas. In other words, once I pick up the first drink of that mind-altering drug, I can no longer predict my behavior. And if you've been having trouble along those lines, I'll guarantee you that tonight you're in the right place. This physical allergy that I developed to this drug is not necessarily what makes it the killer that it is today. There's a mental side of this disease, and it's the real serious one. It's called the obsession of the mind. And it's triggered, incidentally, by the first drink of that mind-altering drug that you pick up that tells you that this time it's going to be different. This is the time I'll be able to predict. This is the time I'll be able to control. This is the time it's going to work for me like it always used to. See, if you be alcoholic like Red, and you pick up that first drink, you trigger your obsession to drink. In the alcoholic, it immediately sets up a compulsion to drink, and you're going to end up, maybe not today, maybe not even this week. But once you trigger that obsession, once you set up that compulsion, you're going to end up in another devastating bout with this mind-altering drug, in which you're just one step closer to the insanity and death that Gigi was reading about a minute ago when she read from that portion of Chapter 5 from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the whole idea, the whole concept of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new or fairly new, is to teach us on a daily basis how to stay away from that first drink. You know, the first 100 guys and a gal that were on this fellowship that were able to do this successfully a day at a time for a year got together and they wrote down what they had done. They called it the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to believe that that first 100 guys and a gal had to be spiritually led. It was over a period of the last 30 years that Red has been sober a day at a time. I have never found myself in a situation that I couldn't find the solution to in that Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous before it was necessary for me to go out there and pick up that first drink. And almost all the answers come in those 12 suggested steps that Gigi read a minute ago. Those are the suggested steps to recovery used by that first 100 guys and a gal that were able to stay sober a day at a time for a year. If you were paying any attention at all when they're read, they are suggested steps to recovery. But I can guarantee you that there's not a guy or a gal in a room like this tonight with any length of sobriety at all that ever had them just suggested to them. You're going to have to take them. You're going to have to do the best you can with them on a daily basis for the rest of your life if you want to become a survivor. Take a look around you in a room like this tonight, and what you see are the survivors of a terminal disease. A disease from which there is no cure, a progressive disease that's going to continue to get worse for the rest of your life, whether you drink or not. If you wonder why Red's standing up here tonight still yapping about the same old thing after over 30 years of sobriety, it's because it's a hell of a lot more important for me to stay sober today than when I was in that first 30 or 60 or 90 days. Because you see, my disease has continued to progress. Ellen and I have a very dear friend, not too long ago, with 22 years, try it. That lady started to drink at 10 in the morning, and by 4 that afternoon, she was dead. just 6 hours for the allergy of alcohol to wipe her out off the face of this earth after 22 years of sobriety. I said a minute ago, regardless of how long it took. I say this from podiums anymore because as I look at these audiences, they keep getting younger on me all the time. Probably because I'm getting so damned old. I don't know. A lot of times I think youth thinks they got here too soon. And if you're thinking like that, my God, forget it. The average age of death today of the guy or the gal with a disease called alcoholism is down to 37. Take a look around. You see a lot of us old jokers still staggering around. So you know how many kids have got to be dying to bring it down to anything like that. It's not extraordinary anymore for somebody to go through the gates of insanity and death before their 16th birthday. Coupled with some of that crap that's out there on the street tonight pushing this progression along, it's not hard to pack 20 years of hard drinking into 4 or 5. So if you are in a room like this tonight, for God's sake, try to pay attention to some of these symptoms I'm going to try to describe. Some of these innermost feelings, and maybe, just maybe, you might save yourself a lot of hell right here on earth. And that's my part of back to basics, gang. I'll get off of this bleeding deacon kick and qualify myself as an alcoholic. I really didn't do any drinking at an early age. I had an obsession. I wanted to fly. I wanted to fly the fastest airplanes ever built. I had a real drawback. I was born back in what they call the Depression years. I know a lot of you aren't even old enough to remember them. I have a feeling you might have had a little touch of them here lately. But things were tough. You know, I knew my chances weren't that great. I started investigating. It seemed to be my only chance. It had to be the military. Except back in those days, we didn't have an Air Force, per se. It was part of what was called the old Army Air Corps. I found to get into it, I was going to have 2 years of college and a senatorial appointment from the state. I knew the money wasn't going to be there for that college education due to the times, and I was no great student, but I was a big kid. I figured I could do it athletically. I stayed clean all the way through high school. I was out for football and basketball. I won my football scholarship to Colorado State University. I wangled my 2 years of college that way, got my senatorial appointment, and they sent me to Randolph Field, which was the old Army Air Corps Academy. And through that period of my training, booze was no problem. I just didn't use it. I graduated as a second lieutenant back in the old Army Air Corps just prior to us getting into World War II. See, a few guys sitting out there tonight can probably remember how unprepared we were for that hassle. You know, our dads were supposed to fought one to end them all, and Congress had never seen too fit to approach the kind of a show we've got today. We got tossed into that North African campaign over there against a bunch of guys that had been sitting there practicing for a couple of years, and they got real good at what they were doing. We were strictly under-trained and for sure under-airplaned. I found myself in a situation on that first tour in which a lot of times we were putting up 25 against 200, and we were getting the hell kicked out of us. I came back up on one of those raids very early in that first tour of duty, and that particular day we only got 8 back out of the 25. Now, I think a lot of you in this room tonight can identify with adrenaline, Mother Nature's drug, usually triggered by fear. Fear of death, fear of failure, fear of the unknown. You get a near miss out here on a freeway, you handle it real good. You get a half mile down the road, you can't keep your foot on the accelerator. That's adrenaline. I'd been in nothing but an adrenaline-type situation for about 6 hours. I was standing in an interrogation line waiting to go in to talk to him about what had happened. And old Red was shaking. I was shaking in every bone in my body. Now, I wasn't too worried about adrenaline shakes. I'd had them a lot of times before. You stand there and wait for that football to come down to that 250-pound lineman about to nail you, and you'll quiver. I don't give a damn who you are. But you get in the game and you get over it, and I knew I'd get over it. But this flight surgeon standing there looking at me wasn't that sure. He says, "What's the matter, Red?" I said, "Nothing. I'll be all right." He looked at me for a few minutes. And he says, "Young man, I got just what you need." I'd never paid any attention to that medicinal table that they had set up there in operations. But on it, they had about a half a dozen open fifths of what they call medicinal whiskey. Think about that for a few minutes. Whiskey is a medicine. reached over and he picked up a water glass and he poured me about two fingers and he said, "Here, drink this." And I looked at him and said, "I really don't want it." He looked me right in the eye and he says, "Young man, I prescribe it." Man, I hung on to that and for the next 20 years. I picked that stuff up, turned it up, walked into interrogation and sat down. And if you got an alcoholic personality like I have, I know you know what happened. Man, that stuff sat there and flowed out there to those fingertips and out there to those toes. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting there real comfortable. I look down and they're roped. You know, 10 minutes before, I hadn't been able to light a cigarette or pick up a cup of coffee. 10 minutes down the line with a half a glass of booze, I mean, I'm looking at them and they're frozen just like they are tonight. And literally, old Red never shook at anything again for the next 20 years. I thought I had found the elixir of life. I really believed it. And booze worked that well for me for a long, long time. Even after it started doing to me, it would still do for me. I soon found to get the full benefit out of it. I had to keep recreating the kind of a situation that I'd had that first day. Probably combat's the best adrenaline builder I ever found before or since. I became a combat freak. I stayed 3 years and two tours of duty. I got good at what I was doing. I learned to live on that knife's edge, that fast lane. Booze was always there at the end of the day to handle anything that I couldn't. God, I'd come in at night, see guys sitting on the edge of their beds worried about going the next day. You know, and I'd look at them and think, geez, I wish they could find alcohol. It never dawned on me that it worked so much better for me than it did for them. Hell, I went right on through World War II. I was back here in the States. I probably should have been able to lay that medication down and go on about my business. But in retrospect, I think I started running into one of the first symptoms of this disease. Some of you might identify with it. It's called justification. Rather than laying it down, I went looking for a job that had some adrenaline in it. All the real good airplanes, the jet-type airplanes that we got today, were just coming off the drawing boards. They were looking for guys that had a lot of combat experience to evaluate them. I put my application in and got accepted as a test pilot to the Proving Ground Command. Hell, the excitement was back. I was flying the kind of airplanes now that I laid on those Colorado hillsides and dreamt about when I was a kid. I was flying with the best, and I knew it. Booze was still working for me. In fact, I think it started working just a little bit too well. Proving Ground Command is Eglin Field in Florida. Still is. They got a big officers club built right out there in the Gulf there at Fort Walton. I used to catch myself an awful lot of nights hanging out at that club until 1 o'clock in the morning. It was kind of tranquilizing the day. And I knew I had a 6:30 test hop. Not always for sure. But every once in a while I'd wake up in that BOQ around 10 o'clock in the morning with that cold sweat start would come to it. I'd look at my watch and say, "Didn't I or didn't I?" You know, you pick up the phone, call the sergeant, and say, "Did I get everything written up they wanted this morning?" "Yes, sir," right down the line. You walk back down to the line, step up on the wing of that bird, and the knee pad is yours. The checkoffs are yours. Signature's yours. Geolometer says you've been up to speed of sound, and the only thing you can't recall is going. Now, don't kid me, it hadn't happened to you. You step out there on that porch in the morning, that car's in the driveway, you say, "How did it get home last night?" Another symptom of this disease is called blackout. The overuse and abuse of the mind-altering drug alcohol to the point that it blacks out the conscious mind. If you've got any coordination at all, you're going to get by with a mile of it. Hell, I've seen guys go for a week in a blackout. You'd never see them stagger. Had no conception of where they were or what they were doing. It should just scare the living hell out of an alcoholic, and I don't believe I've ever met one that it bothered too much. We write her off the idea that, "God, I must have had a good time last night." In the occupation that I was in, I knew it wasn't what I was looking for. I started my first feeble attempts at control. I'd always been a binge drinker at the end of the day. I figured if I was going to exercise control at all, I had to string it out over a longer period of time. And I think this is how a lot of us become daily drinkers. You know, I gave up binge-type drinking, but I didn't give up drinking. I just strung it out over a longer period. It worked great for a long time. Most of the real good airplanes I'd really wanted to test off the drawing board anyway. I was looking for something that had a little more kick to it. Usually the Air Force come up with it. We found that we'd let way too many guys out right after World War II. They started a big recruiting campaign to get the key personnel to come back. One of the promotional aspects they come up with was the organization of what's still known today as the Air Force Demonstration Team. You don't get sentenced to that team. You volunteer for it. I had all the qualifications. I put my application in and got accepted. It's not all fun and games, for sure. You practice with that stuff 4.5 days a week. At that time, we were flying 32 air shows around the country a year. They're up to 48 now. They only let you do it for 2 years, and it's probably enough because it's an adrenaline-building son of a gun. But I was back flying with the best again, and I knew it. Booze was still working for me. I think maybe I started running into another symptom about this time. Some of you might identify with it. It's called hangover. God, I have never found, and this is before or since, a worse place to shake a hangover than an aerobatic formation. You just think about it for a few minutes. You walk out there in the morning, that canopy comes down over you, and you're trapped. There's no way in the world you're going to stop at a corner tavern, that's for damn sure. You hook that oxygen mask across your face, and you can no longer become ill. You pull into that 18-inch interval formation, and those guys just insist that you don't shake. You do a lot, maybe you might identify with this, and it's called the deep sweats. You know, I used to sit there and wonder how come. How come something that's worked for me so well for so long is kicking me around like that? Just to try to analyze it. Get a thinking, hell, maybe it's the life you lead, Brett. Maybe at the end of your 2 years, if you'd resign, get out, get into civilian life, get a business going, get a family started, do the things I'd seen my buddies do, that I could get a handle on this drinking. I always believed right up until I had both feet through the gates of insanity and death that given the right set of circumstances, I could control my drinking. I think this philosophy of self-sufficiency that we all grow up with from kids, where every guy and every gal should be an island to themselves, is probably what helps about 14 to 16 million of those practicing alkies that are out there tonight self-medicate themselves right out of this world without ever finding what we find in rooms like this, that there is a way out. I finished my 2 years. I resigned. I hit civilian life. All my buddies had been out there about 5.5 to 6 years ahead of me. They'd got out right after World War II. They'd gone back to school. They'd completed their educations. They had positions, homes built, families started. If you're anything like I'm an alcoholic, you know what you're going to do. Double up and catch up. And this is the way I hit civilian life. I went into business, built a tri-level home, I got married. The business I went into was immediately successful. I'd grown up in it, and I've been in it most of my sober years. You guys contributed an awful lot to it in your drinking careers. It's called the auto body business. But it was good. I think I'd have been all right if I'd just worked at it 8 hours a day, but I was working 12 and 14, 16 hours a day. I went to 6 days a week, and I put on 2 shifts. I got that tri-level home that I paid for in a short period of time. I got a trust fund. Started for the kids to get them through college, and hell, they're only 1 and 3. This is the way we think, and this is the way we drive. And I'd come through those doors at night, it's a damn beat I could hardly hold my head up. Flop in that easy chair, and there was one thing I could always sell right on. Man, if there's anything you've earned yourself today, Tiger, you know what it was, a drink of booze, and I was no better off than I was sweating hangovers at 30,000. A strange thing happened to me at this time in my life. Oh, Harry Truman got his foot in his mouth and sicked us on Korea. I was telling you we hadn't trained any fighter pilots after World War II. He found it out in a hurry, too. He had to call the war worries. God, just 21 days from the day I was recalled, I looked out there, I got 2 500-pound napalms nailed each wing again. They're saying, sick 'em, Tiger, they just went that way. I got another 100 missions to do. You know, I'm 30 years old by this time. Maybe I don't sound old, but it's getting old for a fighter pilot, especially one with a progressive disease. I had no idea that I had a progressive disease. Hell, I was still passing Class A physicals every 6 months. How could I have a disease? When I started to do that new 100 in Korea, something became quite evident to old Red in a hurry. Those damn missions had got too long between drinks. You know, I told you I'd been a daily drinker now for a hell of a long time. I steal this from my wife's pitch. I think these chains of alcoholism lie so lightly on our shoulders that a lot of us have no idea that they're there until we're just completely enmeshed. Till all of a sudden we wake up one morning to the fact that we're no longer telling alcohol when we're going to drink it. Booze is beginning to tell us when we're going to drink it. I solved that situation very simply. I went over to the PX and I bought myself 2 8-ounce flasks, one for each winter flight boot. And hell, it worked great. I'd use the right one going out and the left one coming home. A long time after booze started doing to me, it would still do for me. You know, I think it was brought out very vividly to me just how hooked I was really getting. Long about my 40th mission, I got shot up again for about the umpteenth time in my life. Shell come through the bottom of the airplane that morning and come right through my left leg, and it kicked it clear into my chin. You know, I still remember getting my foot back down on that rudder, and I could feel liquid running into that left winter flight boot. I still remember sticking my hand down there, pulling her back, and thinking, hot dog, it's blood. Only alcoholics identify with that story. I thought they'd shot my coming home jug out, is what I thought. I still had damn near 30 minutes to make it home, and I was damn glad to find my medication still intact. I didn't mind bleeding a little. This is the way alcohol was letting me think. I finished my 100. I got back here to the States. I got to think, you know, maybe, Red, you could find yourself a flying job far enough away from booze. Maybe you can get someplace where it's not so readily available. As usual, the Air Force took care of it. We were just starting to build the radar sites up across the Arctic Circle. I went north. If any of you are thinking about it, my God, forget it. I spent a year in Thule, Greenland, where the warmest day we had was 23 below. So cold weather won't do it. I finally volunteered to come on back down to Harmon, that big Seagram's distillery there in Newfoundland, to pick up the monthly ration of booze for that base up there. Thule is only about 450 miles from the North Pole. I brought down a twin-engine airplane that afternoon. I loaded her clear down with those big 40-ounce Canadian jugs of that CC and VO. I started back up there that night, and I got into one of the damnedest Arctic storms I was ever in, and I lost an engine. It's one of those nights I called Air Sea Rescue, and those bastards wouldn't even come out. You know, I fought that thing all night. I got into Thule just at Arctic dawn. And the whole base was down there to meet me. I got to thinking, isn't it great they're that worried about old Red? I rolled back that wind, and the first thing they asked me is, you didn't salvo that load, did you? It had never even crossed my mind. I don't know whether you guys had this problem or not. As a daily drinker, I was developing a hell of a smell problem. You know, when you drink booze all day like I did, you smell like booze all day. I got to thinking, you know, maybe if I'd get back to Europe where they got that wine on the table to eat a lot of garlic, that at least I'd blend in better. I volunteered for Fleet Line Service, which is the airline that resupplies NATO. I went back over. You know, my northern run was Brussels, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Oslo, and Stockholm. Those are progressive disease towns, John. It never got better. I was picking up a lot of rank over the years. They kept trying to trap me for command. They got it done. They jerked me back here to the States, sent me through staff and command school, gave me an air defense group, stuck me up at Hamilton just outside of San Francisco. God, now I got 800 men in my command. I'd hear my airplanes roll every morning. Seemed like invariably I'd look out there at that outer office of mine, and that adjutant would always have about a half a dozen of my boys sitting out there waiting for me to talk to. I just found an awful lot of my mornings used to be taken up counseling. These kids have been in town getting themselves into all kind of trouble, and most of it drinking. I had a system. I had an I-zone safe along my side of my desk. I used to keep a 40-ounce jug of Smirnoff Red Vodka in there with a hooked glass straw. Every time he'd go out to get one of those boys, I'd hit the safe. And usually by noon, I was giving some pretty damn good lectures on the evils of drink. Also knew I was going to get in one hell of a lot of trouble sooner or later. Air Force had always been awful good to me all my life. I figured I showed them a lot more than I was giving them lately. Again, I decided to resign. This time it didn't work. My resignation got as far as Air Defense Command at Colorado Springs. They reviewed it and bounced it. They bounced it with a recommendation that be sent to Parks, which is one of the big Air Force hospitals, for 3 months psychoanalysis. Couldn't figure out why a 15-year light colonel all of a sudden wanted to throw his command in. I couldn't very well go in and tell him why. If I had any other terminal disease in this world, I'd have been in there on that doctor's doorstep every morning, laying the symptoms on them. You know, telling them, God, doc, this is where it hurts. Yet you can drag that dying alcoholic into that same doctor's office, read him that same set of questions. When it comes to that one where it says, do you drink excessively? Oh, a couple of beers now and then, doc. Self-denial, the greatest symptom of all the symptoms I've been trying to describe. Our complete lack of our innermost selves to get honest enough to admit alcohol has just taken us to pieces. I had to spend that 3 months on that psychiatric ward. This was a long time ago. It was before, well, it was the first help that was ever offered to me as an alcoholic. I don't believe that psychiatry could possibly help the practicing alcoholic due to the self-honesty bit. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't believe there's anybody in here tonight that psychiatry probably couldn't help just a little bit. I got to tell you my psych story. This guy had an obsession. He had a purple screw for a belly button. That was his obsession. Every time he looked down, there it was, a bright purple screw right where his belly button should be. He knew it was an obsession. He finally goes to this shrink and he says, Doc, do you think you could help me? He says, I haven't got a good night's sleep in months worrying about this. And Doc looked him over and says, yeah. He says, I think I can. He says, I just got this new potion in. He says, I want you to take it home with you. He says, get in your best pajamas, open your bedroom window, drink this stuff down. He says, you'll drift right off to sleep. In will float a little pink cloud. It'll have a little purple handled screwdriver on it. He says, I want you to unscrew that thing, lay it up there, let it float out. He says, you'll get your night's sleep. The guy looked at him and says, I'm going to try this, Doc. He went running home. He went through the routine, and it worked. In floated the cloud. He unscrewed it. Out it floated. Got the night's sleep he'd been looking for months. Woke up the next morning. Covers were up. Finally raised him up, took a quick look. Sure enough, normal belly button. He was just elated. He jumped out of bed and his ass fell off. The reason I tell you this story, guys, is it's exactly the way that psychiatry worked for Red. They would fix me up. They'd say, go get him, Tiger. I jumped out there and off it. It'd fall again. Like I said, I spent 3 months on that psychiatric ward. I had 3 appointments with those doctors a week. The rest of the time I had open post. The club opened every day at 12 o'clock and closed at 1 in the evening. I opened it every day at 12, closed it at 1. And that 3 month period, those guys never saw me that I wasn't bombed out of my mind. And yet there's not one mention in that medical report of the word alcoholism. You see, they really didn't recognize it as a treatable disease at that time. They did let me out. Family has long since got tired of my shenanigans and been on their way. My folks had moved out here to the West Coast, and they'd been real successful. I had a big home over there on top of Palo Verde Hills there behind San Pedro. I figure I'll get up there in that big den with that boob tube and that beautiful view of Los Angeles Harbor. All the pressures I've been drinking at through a couple of wars are off my back. I'm going to get a handle on this drinking. I lasted about 2 weeks up there, and I was going out of my gourd. It was one of those big wooden globes, one of those Columbus-type globes sitting in that den. I kept looking at that thing and thinking, you know, maybe, Red, you've never taken a true geographic. I'd always been around guys that could cover for me, guys that had flown combat or gone to school. I figured if I'd get someplace in this world far enough away from anybody that knew me, that I'd have to do it on my own. I run my finger over toward the meridian to see what was on the other side of the world from Palo Verde. If you want to try it, it's Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. When I was flying fleet line service, I used to hang out down Athens a lot, and I'd run into those pilots from Saudi Arabia and Ethiopia. I knew that TWA hired them. I had a good personnel manager friend that worked for TWA. I called him up and said, hey, I'm looking for a job. 1 month later, I was flying captain on Ethiopian Airlines. I'm halfway around the world again. Nobody knows Red. All he knows is he's got lots of flying time, and he's qualified. I gave it my best shot. I don't know whether any of you guys tried white-knuckle sobriety or not, but I stayed sober a year on guts. And if you're thinking about it, my God, forget it. It was the most miserable year I ever spent in my life, before or since. There wasn't a waking moment in that year that I didn't want to drink. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, have to go down to the kitchen, pour myself one, set it on a table, and sweat it. Not drink it. Prove yourself you've got guts enough, Red. I'd go to a movie, and I'd get up in the middle of it, go to the bar, and have the bartender pour me one. Drink it. Sit there and sweat it. That's the way I went through the year. At the end of it, I figured, well, there's one thing you proved, Tiger. At least you're not an alcoholic. And I went out to celebrate. In my last fight. I don't remember ever fighting that. We come up that hill so gradually we hit that level off period. You finally get over on the backside of that alcoholic curve. I'll guarantee you, once you hit the backside of that curve, you're going to start donating to the pot to reserve your right to use this drug. Jobs, securities, homes, things that we've worked hard for most of our lives, you're going to find yourself tossing them into the pot to reserve your right to use this drug. Families, loved ones, people that have stuck by us through hell and high water, all of a sudden we're tossing them into the pot to reserve our right to use this drug. If you want to hang out there as long as Red did, you're going to get things like integrity, self-respect. Anything that means anything to you on the backside of that curve, you got to donate. I used to look down and say, if I ever got like that joker, I would quit. Pretty soon I'd be just like him, and I'd say, I mean that one down there. It wasn't too many years before they quit renewing my airline contracts. Africa, about this time, most of those colonial powers were going independent. I found there was a hell of a demand for the kind of flying I'd been doing most of my life. All of a sudden, I found Red shooting at people for money. You know, this has a funny effect on your insides. I'd always had principles to fight for through a couple of wars. Now I'm just sitting out there shooting at guys to support a habit that I don't seem to be able to do too much about. There's a lot of other pressures that can be put on practicing alcoholics, as all of you know. I told you I'd been CO of an air defense group that helped build the radar sites, had flown with the test division. I had a top secret clearance all my military career. Now I'm flying for a foreign government. You hear things like OSI and CIA, you don't think too much about it. But I can guarantee you they're out there. and they can give a practicing Elkie fits. They know who's paying you, they know how much, they know where you're banking it, they're opening your mail. Maintenance isn't worth a damn. You don't get shot down in that part of the world. All these pressures are building. I'm doing the one thing that's always worked. I'm pumping that booze. And it got worse. It finally got so bad that they even quit hiring me for it. I ended up, and I'm sure as hell not proud of this, flying through mountain passes with my landing lights on railroad tracks for navigation. Now my flights are low level over water. My landing fields are deserted beaches and they're flashlight lit. I have a feeling you know what I'm doing. I'm smuggling because that's where the money is. That's where all the fears are too. If I get caught doing what I'm doing now, I know they'll put me away for life. And yet alcohol took all those choices away. If you want to hang out there as long as Red did and you live, that's exactly what it's going to do to you. I kept right on with that kind of a crappy existence till I finally got so bad they even quit hiring me for it. I was back here in the States. I was 41 years old. I guess probably I was about as unemployable as a guy can really get. I figured there wasn't too many things I hadn't tried a couple times in this world. If I couldn't whip it, at least I could get with it. I bought myself 10 cases of those 40-ounce jugs of that Smirnoff Red Vodka, and I stuck them in that hillside over there in Palo Verde. And I went on what was supposed to be old Red's last drunk, and I just damn near made it. This was 32 years ago. It was before detox or care centers or hospitals that have anything to do with an alcoholic. People who were on the side of that hill had no idea what was wrong with me. Hell, I'd been out there among them since I was 18. They'd really never been around me that often. They knew I was getting awful sick physically. That drunk lasted 64 days. The last 30 of it I hadn't eaten. My normal weight's about 220. I was down to 138 pounds of emaciation. Most of that was liver. Any cirrhosis victims out there? I think God stepped in my life at this time. Those people picked a doctor out of the phone book to see if he'd make a house call. And you know that doctor actually made that house call. I know today that he didn't do it because of his Hippocratic Oath. They happened to pick one that's a member of a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. He listened to those symptoms on the phone. He told those people what I was up against and then made that house call. I know today that he was making a 12-step call. He told those people what I was up against, said he'd seen some amazing recovery on a program that he himself was trying. He was going to do what he could for me physically. He was going to leave some names, and if I asked for help, to call you. I never remember getting that well. He thought I was going to die, and they thought I was going to die. So I guess they just called you. My first recollection of you sober guys were those guys sitting on the edge of that bed. And you know, they literally nursed old Red back to health and started hauling me into rooms like this. And you new guys look pretty good tonight. Man, I was a tongue-chewing, wet-brain-babbling idiot when they hauled me in here. But thank God you read that portion of chapter 5 like Gita did tonight, because I think that's what saved old Red's life. I wasn't capable of hearing too much. I could just hear, just don't drink today. And then they'd read those 12 suggested steps. And all of a sudden, sitting at that old maritime meeting over there in Wilmington one Saturday night, about 30 days sober, they had just read that portion of chapter 5, and it all come crashing in, what I'd been trying to put together. You see, for many years, drunk or sober, the only thing that had ever kept me alive in those complicated airplanes I'd been flying was called a checklist. A list in which everything I had to do to get through one flight was written down. And I'd never gone near a bird in my life, drunk or sober, that I hadn't used that checklist from the time I walked up until the time I walked away. And it'd get me through just one flight. Sitting back there that night, all of a sudden it dawned on me what 24 hours really is. 24 hours is just one flight in life. And those 12 suggested steps are the checklist to keep you from ever having to go back out there and pick up that first drink of booze. I've been using that 12-step checklist on a daily basis now for the last almost 31 years. I've never found it necessary to go back out there and pick up another drink of alcohol, a tranquilizing, sedating, elevating pill. Haven't had to smoke any funny grass. I guess probably I've been as close to chemically free as a guy can stay in this modern world. And I owe it all to you guys. See, on my own, I'd given it my best shot. And I'd never scratched the surface. Everything I've been talking about tonight, I've learned in rooms like this. If you got your hand up recently and you said, my name is whatever it is, and I'm an alcoholic, you pretty well got that number one step nailed. That's what we're talking about. We admit that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives are unmanageable. And that's just about what you're able to do when you hit your feet in front of a bunch of your peers and say, my name is Red, and I'm an alcoholic. If you're anything like I was, though, and you hit that step number two, that one will just jar the living hell out of you. There's a real inference in that step. I'm going to have to ask a power greater than old Red to restore me to sanity. You know, before I can take that step, I got to admit I'm nuts. I got to admit I had to be. Where else would you find a guy completely allergic to a drug that if he continued to use it was going to kill him that went out there and pumped it down a couple of fifths a day? There's got to be all kind of insanity in us before we ever come through those doors. Don't let it shake you too much. I'm going to tell you my insanity story. For years, by the time I'd get my shop closed in Long Beach and get out to Buena Park and change clothes and then double back up to speak at meetings I was scheduled to, I was always driving like a son of a gun to get there in time through that traffic. This guy was doing the same thing. He was on the freeway. It was only about 10 minutes from the meeting he had to be at. His off-ramp was coming up. He thought he had it nailed. He hit the off-ramp, got a couple of blocks down the street, and blew a tire. He jumped out, and it's flat. He thought, well, maybe I can still make it. He ran around, jerked his trunk open, got his spare out, jacked his car up, whipped his lug nuts off, put him in a hubcap behind him. He just set his spare up. Car come whizzing along behind him, caught the edge of the hubcap, and flipped all his lug nuts right out in the weeds. And he's frantic. He's out there beating his weeds to death, and he can't find him. He knows he's going to be late, and he's wringing his hands. And all of a sudden, he heard a voice. He hadn't paid any attention where he'd rolled to a stop. He looked up, and he was parked right in front of an institution for the alcoholically insane. One of the inmates had been sitting up there on a fence watching all this. He says, hey, mister. The guy says, I haven't got time to talk to you right now. He says, I'm in a hell of a hurry. The guy sitting up on a fence says, you know, I've been sitting up here watching you. He says, I figured you must be. He says, hell, if I was in that big a hurry, he said, I'd take the other three hubcaps off, take a lug nut off of each wheel, put that thing on there, and get going. The guy looked at him and says, oh, my God. He says, that's the answer. He says, how did you come up with that? I thought you were insane. The guy says, I am, but that's no sign I'm stupid. The point I'm trying to make is this, gang. All of us, when we come through those doors back there, are a wee bit bent out of shape. We've been out there kicking ourselves around for a hell of a long time. The mere fact that we come looking for help sure as hell proves that we're not stupid. This is where the answers are in rooms like this. Guys and gals sharing their experience, strength, and hope with each other that we can solve this common problem. I hit that step number three, and I think all of you know what happened. I run into that word God. I went running for my sponsor, and I said, Mac, is that the God they're talking about? He says, yeah, Red. I said, I haven't got a chance. I got 250,000 years in purgatory to do before I could even start this program. I got the kind of a personality with these new swimming suits that are out that just walk by a pool and pick up 25,000 years. Yeah.
He said, "You didn't read the small print, Tiger." I said, What are you talking about? He said, "The God of your understanding." I knew I was going to have to turn my will and my life over to a power greater than red. And all of a sudden it dawned on me that there was one right there in front of me. You guys. Man, I could believe in group power. I'd been tucked up in groups all my life. As long as I was in a group, I had all the firepower in the world. It was only when I was out there as a straggler I was going to get my ass shot down. I started hanging with the winners, the guys that had some time on this program. I started listening to them. I started picking their brains. And they taught me. They taught me real good about this power that the Dale Red calls a God. My sobriety on a daily basis is a gift from you guys and God. What I do with that sobriety is my gift back to Him. You see, He's let me become part of that pipeline of information started by that first 100 guys and the gal. The only way I can keep it is to keep giving it away. I got to be standing at that door or up here at the podium when the new guy or the new gal comes in. I got to share my experience, strength, and hope with them like they did with me when I come through that door. This is the fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. I got down to number 11. And it was talking about God's will for Red. It seems like after 30 years or better, that Red's will and God's will would kind of start to come together like this. But it don't happen. They stay right on that same parallel all the time. I heard a story over in Vegas the other night kind of illustrates what I'm talking about. This guy must have been an alky. He'd been out of work all during that slow period we had. He finally got himself a good job in a supermarket in the produce department, keeping all the lettuce and tomatoes and vegetables laid out, wet down, looking good. All of a sudden, one afternoon, this guy come in and cornered him, and he says, "Young man," he says, "I want to buy half a head of your lettuce." The kid looked at him and says, "I'm sorry, sir, we don't sell half a heads of lettuce." Now, I've been dealing with the public for a lot of years, and I know how irritating they can get when they want to be. This guy stayed right in the middle of him. He says, "Hey, I'm a bachelor." He said, "Look at the price of that stuff. It'd just go to waste. Sell me a half a head of lettuce." Kid stuck with his guns. He says, "No, sir, we don't sell it that way." The guy wouldn't let up on him. He says, "Why don't you go back and ask your store manager whether he'll sell me a half a head?" By this time, the kid is steaming, and I can understand those kind of emotions. He goes charging back into that store manager's office. He says, "There's some half-assed character out here that wants to buy half a head of lettuce." He turned around, and the guy had walked in right behind him. And he says, "And this gentleman here would like to buy the other half." See the difference between Red's will and God? I hit that number 12. And it said, having had a spiritual awakening. And nothing had happened. I got to go to a convention about my first 60 days. I heard an old boy from the podium down at Palm Springs. He sounded spiritual. He sounded spiritual every time I ever heard him after that. Passed away down Laguna a few years back. Author of A New Pair of Glasses. John was talking about him last night. I took him aside after that convention. I said, "Come on, Chuck, tell me about spiritual." And he said, "I'm glad you asked, Red." He said, "I did a lot of research on it." He said, "I come up with a definition." I said, "That's what I'm looking for, something this alky brain can handle." He said, "Red, spiritual is that which is not material." You know, I started reading this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous real conscientiously to find out what that first 100 guys and the gal had in mind when they put that in her. The more I read it, the more I became convinced what they were talking about were my attitudes and my emotions. These are the things that had always driven me back out there to pick up that first drink. Alcohol was merely a symptom of what was wrong with me. My attitude, prior to finding you guys, when I'd step out there and take a look at the day, it was, oh God, another day. And it had been that way for a long, long time. What you guys have taught me is to step out there and take a look at the day and say, thank God, another day. See, I've been granted one I shouldn't have had. The average age of death when I come through those doors was 41. And I told you a minute ago how old I was. I just barely snuck in. Means that every day that I've been granted over the last 30-some years is a gift from you guys and God. And you can't get too ungrateful for a situation like that. I get up to a podium and I get right up on cloud nine. I got to tell you my attitude story. This guy walked into a barber shop not too long ago. He was right up on cloud nine. The barber got him in the chair and he says, what are you so happy about? The guy says, I got a 747 reservation going to Rome. He said, I'm going over there and eat some of that good Italian food. He said, I even got an audience with the Pope. The barber looked at him and says, what's the matter with you, man? He says, that 747 is the roughest airplane in the sky. He says, you'd be airsick all the way over there. He says, you start eating that Italian food and Montezuma's revenge is going to seem mild. He says, you know the Pope isn't going to have time for a commoner like you. Now, the guy had gone in there right on cloud nine. He came out after the haircut right down in the pits. You know, right where those norms usually drop me. He didn't see him for 30 days. And all of a sudden, a guy come bounding through the door, and he is really out of sight this time. He got him back in the chair, and he says, what now? He says, I made that trip. He says, that 747 is the smoothest airplane in the sky. He says, there wasn't a ripple going over. He said, I gained 10 pounds eating that Italian food. It was the best I ever had. He said, I even got my audience with the Pope. I got to kneel at his feet, kiss his ring. And he says, would you believe he even had a question for me? The barber looked at him and says, what could he possibly ask you? He says, where did you get that lousy haircut? Don't let them tear you down yet. I can't guarantee you get your wives back, your husbands back, your kids back, your health back, your jobs back. But I can guarantee you those 12 suggested steps are going to give you the tools to start digging into that pile of stuff you brought through the door. And if you'll use them as tools, I can also guarantee you that you're going to start to uncover in a hurry something that you can live with pretty comfortably for as long as you want to hang around this program, a day at a time. So much for attitudes. How about emotions? 5 different places in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous mentions the one thread, the one trend that seems to run through all our personalities as alcoholics is a little thing called emotional immaturity. How could a 41-year-old fighter jock be emotionally immature? You know, I had a hard time buying that in the beginning. I don't today, because over a period of the last better than 30 years that Red's been sober a day at a time, it's probably the one character defect that I've had to work on almost constantly. I looked up that word immaturity in the dictionary, and you know what it said? Childlike. From the very first time that that flight surgeon handed me that drink of booze in that interrogation line many years ago, my emotions had shut down. I had never had to grow up. I'd always had a crutch. It's brought out to me very vividly out here at Buena Park and where I live exactly what they're talking about. This is something that's been going on for well over 30 years. Every Saturday morning, along about 9 o'clock, there's a knock on old Red's front door. It's all the kids in the neighborhood gathered out there on my lawn wanting to know if I can come out and play. And I do. There's a lot of dads that don't have the time to get the wheels back on the skateboards and the balls pumped up and do a few one-on-one moves, you know, and all the things that kids love to do. I could never figure out how I got along with kids so well. I have all my life. I began to realize that the reason I always had is because their emotions were my emotions. Did you ever see one of those little guys get mad? He gets red-faced, fist clenched, drawn back, swinging, angry, mad. Now, who does this remind you of? He'll pick up a resentment and he won't talk to the rest of us for the rest of the day. He's going to punish us. Anybody identify with those kind of emotions? See, it's no wonder we come through those doors and start growing up together. Hell, I've gone back through my teens with those kids. You know, every once in a while, Ellen comes to the door. And they look up and say, oh, it's Red's mother. Like I say, we've grown up together. I've gone back through my teens with those kids. Some of those kids that come knocking on that door have been doing it for 30 years. Some of those kids that used to put their wheels back on their skateboards and now I'm helping port and relieve their automobiles. We got a good thing going. When they got in trouble with that crap that's out there on the street tonight, they knew where to bring themselves and their buddies. And I've had a lot of luck in that direction. And I'd have missed it. I'd have missed it all if it hadn't been for you guys. I still have a hell of a time with that turn it over button. I don't know if you guys have that trouble or not. After 30 years, it seems like you wouldn't have too much trouble turning your will and your life over to the care of God. And I don't have any trouble turning it over. But I have a lot of trouble leaving it there. You know, when it starts getting good, guess who wants to take the credit for it? I'm going to close a little incident that happened to me down at the shop a couple of years ago, just before I decided to retire. I got up one morning there in Buena Park. I had a whole bunch of situations that morning down there. I really didn't want to go down and handle them. I'm still pretty good at procrastination. I hem and hawed around that house until I finally hit that 91 freeway going to Long Beach running late. Now, even to this day, when Red hits a freeway running late, strange things begin to happen. People get cut out. Horns get blown. Fingers get given. You know, I'm filled in a head of steam, and I haven't even got to work yet. And whenever I start to act that way, that old monster inside of me begins to lash. That one that used to whip me right over to that corner tavern. I got to run that checklist, and man, I hit that turn it over button, and it's froze in a down position. You know, I haven't turned anything over to God. I talked to him just like I'm talking to you guys. I said, okay, sir, I'll just go down and do the footwork. You have it. I got down there that morning. None of that stuff that I'd anticipated ever did come in. Everything that did come in was just as smooth as glass. It was a nice day. It was a nice day all day long. Now, I jumped in that same car that night, headed out 91 on my way home. Guess who I'm patting on the back for the way I handled that situation? All of a sudden, it dawned on me I was taking credit where it wasn't due, and I busted out laughing. And I looked over, and the guys driving on each side of me on the freeway are tuning radios trying to find what the hell I'm listening to in there. But it reminded me of a story that I used to use back in my combat days about credit, where credit's due. I had 6 clusters to my DFC, and when I'd wear them, guys would look at me and they'd say, where in the hell did you ever get those, Red? I used to have a stock answer. I got pushed in the pond. But the story goes like this. It's about a Texas rancher. He had one of the biggest spreads in Texas. Thousands of acres, big old Olympic-sized pool, barbecue area, rambling ranch house. Just as a conversation piece, he built himself about 150-yard across alligator pond. Filled it with the meanest damn alligators he could find the world over, these big old 15-foot snappers. And he didn't feed them too good. He kept mean out there. All these guys got out there one afternoon drinking his booze and telling these war stories, and this Texan finally got a little tired of them. He says, I'll tell you what I'll do. He says, any of you guys really want to prove your courage? Anybody go down there and swim across that alligator pond? He says, I'll give you my daughter's hand in marriage, $1 million or a ranch like mine. Figured he'd shut him up for good. He no more turned his back. He hears all this commotion. He turned around, and here this guy is swimming out across that pond. And, man, he is moving out. He's leaving a rooster tail. He made it. The Texan run around helped him out. He says, I've never seen such a display of courage. He says, I'll stick with my bargain. He says, I imagine you want my daughter's hand. The guy shook his head and he says, oh, no, sir. He says, I'm already married. He looked at him. He says, well, he says, then it's got to be the $1 million. The guy shook his head. He says, no, sir. He says, I have an income for life. He looked at him and says, then there's only one other thing it could be. He says, I imagine you want the ranch like mine. The guy shook his head and he says, no, sir. He says, my daddy left me one in his will. He looked at him and he says, well, what do you want? He says, I want the name of that son of a bitch that pushed me in the pond. You've been a great audience, gang. Just remember, every single one of us in this room tonight got pushed into that pond of alcohol. For sure, no human power could have ever got us out of there. God can and He will if He is sought. May you find Him now. May that power watch over us all a day at a time through the eternity of our spiritual existence. I sure want to thank you guys for letting me share.